Well, it's great to be back in Harperistan. This is the dark ages in Canada. I'm sure you know that. War on science, muzzling of science, scientists. You have contempt for democracy, as was mentioned. There are many such instances of this. I personally know the case of Jaggi Singh at Concordia University in Montreal, supposedly a very liberal, open city. He was banned from the university because he protested the visit of Benjamin Netanyahu a few years ago. And I had gone also to Montreal shortly after that, and to speak not at Concordia, but at McGill. And I was with Jaggi because I knew him and what had happened to him. And we had government agents following us around. Even, I mean, they were kind of very obvious, and very blatant. They weren't even subtle about it. And I think it was just to send a message of intimidation, make sure that Jaggi would not go back on the campus or that I would not accompany him in some nefarious deed. But I think it's important to talk about free speech in a putative democracy. Canada and the U.S. Have for quite some time now equated elections with democracy. If democracy means anything at all, it means the incorporation and tolerance of a disparate opinion. And when opinion is limited, when consent is manufactured, when the scope of discussion is not from A to Z, it's from A to B, then there are serious problems with democracy in the United States and in Canada and in other so-called liberal Western democracies. So I want to salute the coalition against Israeli apartheid and the efforts that they are making here in this community to bring these issues, to focus on these issues. Is Desmond Tutu an anti-Semite? He has, incidentally, a Nobel Prize winner from South Africa. He has equated Israeli policy in the occupied territories equivalent to apartheid. And he's not the only one. It's many other people as well, Richard Falk in the United States. And you might know that there's in the US, there's this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that is trying to get some kind of to exert more pressure on the Israeli government, which is supported very fervently by Washington. I think, maybe just kind of inject a little humor here for a moment, because it's pretty heavy stuff we're talking about. And I learned from Howard Zinn a long time ago that humor is also important. So if you'll bear with me for a moment, we interrupt this program to bring you this breaking news story from TIBC, the Truth in Broadcasting Corporation, from our world corporate headquarters in a secure underground location in Area 51 in Nevada. I'm Dick Veneer, your glib and banal anchor of Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. We go straight to the surface of a story and we stay there. No one can beat our in-shallow award-winning broadcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, an amazing story coming across our news desk. CKUD, an obscure radio station in Winnipeg, is reporting that Stephen Harper, John Baird, and Peter McKay have been arrested. They were found in compromising circumstances, burrowed deep in a secret tunnel under Investors Group Field, with a stash of World Wrestling Federation DVDs and a massive collection of Kenny G and Barry Manilow CDs, all with Iranian serial numbers. They were taken into custody by a heretofore unknown group calling itself WLF, the Winnipeg Liberation Front. Michael, a spokesperson for this group, who would not give his full name, incidentally, said, "This action is long overdue. We're dedicated to nonviolence and did not use force on Harper or his cohorts. But we had to act. We could no longer wait for Parliament to enforce the law. Harper must face justice," he declared, with his voice rising in indignation. Harper, handcuffed in an orange jumpsuit and with a black cloak over his head, was later reported to have defiantly shouted at his captors, "Do you know who I am? I am the Prime Minister of Canada. I am one of the leaders of the free world. I serve Jesus Christ. I am doing God's work on this earth." And then, inexplicably to everyone's surprise, he burst into tears and said, "I want my dad." Harper will be tried at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. He faces multiple life sentences if convicted for, among other things, crimes against the environment and First Nations. If convicted, he will serve time at Guantanamo. He'll have plenty of company. Already serving in that prison is George Bush, Dick Cheney, Tony Blair, Jack Straw, Paul Wolfowitz, and Donald Rumsfeld. It looks like curtains for Harper. His head was bowed as he was heard whimpering as he was led away by the blue-helmeted peacekeepers of Wolof, the Winnipeg Liberation Front. I'm Dick Veneer, your still glib and banal anchor of Facade News. Stay tuned to Facade News on the TIBC network for updates on this breaking news story. Remember, we deceive, you believe. You either watch our news or you will be watched. Now back to our regularly scheduled program. So, I created this character, Dick Veneer and Facade News, because it seemed so close to reality. It didn't seem like fiction to me, because a lot of what passes as broadcast news, be it in radio or TV, as well as in print, reads like absolute fiction. And so this character takes on many manifestations, and I kind of changed the script a little bit, but people seem to respond to Facade News, the 24/7 newscast dedicated to keeping you in the dark. So I bring you greetings from the United Stasis of America, or as Gore Vidal used to call it, the United States of Amnesia. As you know, we are now in the midst of a huge scandal about government spying. I don't think you have those kinds of issues in Canada, do you, with Peter MacKay or the former Liberal government under Paul Martin that signed a secret decree in 2005 allowing for warrantless wiretapping on all Canadian telecommunications, both telephone as well as email. And Peter MacKay has now given a directive to update that particular, in 2011 they updated it, and you have the Communications Security Establishment here, as well as CSIS. So Canada is well on its way to emulating the great democracy to its south in terms of surveilling its citizenry and marginalizing free speech. So I was also glad last night to land in Canada with no incident, because 2 months ago when I landed at, is it still called the Lester B. Pearson International Airport in Toronto? Yeah, it is. He's an interesting character, by the way. If any of you know about the history of the formation of the Israeli state, Lester Pearson was a very key player in supporting the creation of Israel. So there's a little background to that. And he was also, you know, a major player in Indochina in supporting the U.S. wars in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s as well. I remember Chomsky saying in a lecture once in Toronto to the gasps of people in the audience there that he had landed today at the war criminals airport, that this was the only airport at that time, that was at that time, named after a war criminal. Of course, now in the United States, you know, it's like one airport after another is named after a war criminal. But Canada maybe had that distinction first. So a couple of months ago, when I landed at Pearson Scareport, that's what they are these days, Scareports, I was taken aside by the customs immigration people. I mean, they were looking in my passport with much interest. Gee, I guess these Pakistani and Syrian and Turkish and Egyptian visas caught their attention, but there was one in particular that stood out, and that was my Iranian visa. And Canada, of course, in its great sagacity under Harper, severed diplomatic relations with Iran, thus, you know, really abandoning thousands and thousands of Canadian Iranians, as well as Iranian students in this country, to any kind of diplomatic representation. There was really no rational explanation as to why Canada did this, why the Harper government did this, other than just to maybe pile on or curry favor with Washington. But nevertheless, Canada did make that move. And so because of this Iranian visa, I was taken aside and asked, you know, well, where are you going in Toronto? What are you doing? Where are you staying? All those kinds of things. And nothing much happened other than the usual kind of interrogation that goes on. And then I was, you know, sent on my merry way, enjoy your visit to Canada. And I'm sure everything was recorded as well as filmed. Now, 1967, I'm again jumping around a little bit, was very, very significant in terms of evolving U.S. policy toward Israel. Prior to 1967, Washington pretty much had a hands-off attitude toward Israel. It wasn't hostile, it wasn't overly friendly, it was just kind of, you know, neutral. But in 67, and prior to that, France was the main supporter of Israel in terms of weapons and also nuclear technology, which is one reason that Israel was to very quickly develop nuclear capability. Israel, incidentally, is not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is another example of the kind of, you know, double standards, quadruple standards that exist in the real world, not in the imaginary world of pundits at the Globe and Mail or the National Post or at the CBC or NPR in the US or PBS. In the real world, you have three countries that are not signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel is one of them. The other two are India and Pakistan, countries that are quite near to Iran. So Iran has like three countries fairly in close proximity that are non-signatories to the treaty and are given a complete free pass by Washington. Again, international law is another term of propaganda. It's only to be applied to designated enemies and rogue states. It doesn't apply to the master and the master's servants. So India, Pakistan, and Israel have no kind of restraints on them. No one is going to the UN. Harper or John Baird, his illustrious foreign minister, is not issuing statements about international law and that Pakistan and Israel and India should sign the non-proliferation treaty. But Iran is a signatory, and as a signatory, has the right to enrich uranium. You know, and so this issue is, again, front page news in Pakistan and India and that part of the world, West Asia and South Asia, but it's barely commented on here. And so Iran is being subjected to collective punishment right now, which is very similar to what many Palestinians go through when Israel decides to close off Gaza or close off parts of the West Bank. So back again to 1967, the Arab-Israeli war occurs. Israel demolishes the Arabs. Incidentally, the war was, there was a lot of provocation on both sides, but Israel was in fact launched the war, a preemptive strike against the Egyptian Air Force, claiming that they were about to attack and this kind of thing. It's maybe a little bit murky, but Israel emerges holding the Golan Heights of Syria. It had captured East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza, as well as the Sinai Peninsula. And this war and the rapidity of it, it was a blitzkrieg, very much impressed Washington and Pentagon military strategists, because they were looking for allies in the Middle East, you know, to affect what was called the policy under Nixon of local cops on the beat. Now, police headquarters stays in Washington. You know, if anything gets really serious, then the big boys come in, you know, great white Americans mostly. But for local skirmishes and for local, you know, small-scale wars, we want local cops on the beat to carry out those operations. And preferably they should be non-Arabs, because you cannot trust the Arabs to police themselves. So who became the local gendarmes in the Middle East at this very crucial junction? Pakistan, non-Arab, although Muslim. Turkey, non-Arab, although Muslim. Iran, non-Arab, and Israel. So these were the four local U.S. allies that would secure the area for U.S. domination of that very precious commodity, oil. And so it's after 67 that the billions of dollars start to stream from Washington to Tel Aviv in military aid. Alliances are built up over and over again. Secured various treaties, technology is exchanged, all kinds of things. And I was reminded, actually by a comment you made, that Harper, in fact, has equated any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. This argument, it's not an argument, it's a calumny. It's a lie, it's blasphemy of a sort, is frequently deployed in the United States as well to silence any kind of criticism, to silence dissent. And I think it's, you know, it's very important that we speak out and, of course, make that distinction between people who hate Jews, which is deplorable and totally unacceptable, and criticisms of a state. And apparently, to ruling circles in Washington and in Ottawa, there's no distinction made. Since Israel is the state of the Jewish people, any criticism of Israel is de facto anti-Semitism. It's used to silence debate. So after 67, this alliance is built up. There's an intifada in 87. I know I'm condensing a lot of material here. Leads to the so-called Oslo Accords of 1993. This is now the 20th anniversary coming up in just a few weeks, actually a few months in September, of the Oslo Accords. And these accords that were signed with, I don't know if you remember it, it's a pretty young audience, were signed, you know, with huge acclaim. This was a new age dawning, huge, you know, amount of propaganda, you know, celebrating this event. But in fact, the treaty document that was signed was almost 100% win for Israel. Very little was given to the Palestinians. Not even the right of self-determination or statehood was part of the Oslo Accords. How Arafat and the PLO could have signed this document drove Edward Said and Iqbal Ahmed and Tariq Ali and other friends I know completely up the wall. Maybe after being in exile for so many years, he was so desperate for a little crumb to have a desk with a flag on it and to be, you know, to be invited to speak at the UN, that was enough for him to concede one point after another. There was even no mention of settlements in the Oslo Accords. Now, settlements should be called colonies. Because I think to speak clearly, as Orwell advises us time and time again, is very, very important. Because if we don't speak clearly and name things as they are, we're left in a cloud. We're left in this kind of being totally obfuscated. Reality and understanding is totally obfuscated. This is a colonization scheme that has been launched that now exceeds up to 600,000 settlers, or colonizers, on Palestinian land, on the West Bank. And the recently announced extension called E1 of the Male Adumim colony will effectively cut off East Jerusalem, bifurcate the West Bank, and make a viable Palestinian state virtually impossible. Also, the settlements, from the Israeli point of view, have the virtue of being built on what? On aquifers. Have any of you been to the Middle East? Do you think this water is a slight problem there? It's a major problem. And so much of the water resources have been confiscated by the Israeli government in these projects. And that too is rarely discussed in the United States. I don't know if there's much commentary on it here in Canada, not much. But this is what has happened is a kind of settler colonialism that Maxime Rodinson wrote about that's not very different from what has happened in many other countries as well. And how is that going to change? How can this land confiscation be rolled back? I think it's going to be very, very difficult. And I think part of the, again, to get back to language, as Chomsky and Orwell and George Lakoff and others have kind of told us about, it's important to talk clearly about what these policies mean. For example, Washington is always talking about international law. I mentioned that a few moments ago, but it's international law selectively applied. It's not uniformly applied. And for law and morality, for that matter, to have any meaning at all, it has to be across the board. You can't say, well, today is Friday, we're going to give you this, apply this law to you, and then tomorrow we're going to apply this law to you. So international law is defined in a peculiar way, just as international community is a term of propaganda. What does the international community mean? It means those countries that go along with Washington's diktats. That's the international community. So when the Non-Aligned Summit happened in Tehran last August, where something like 150 countries, these were the former kind of the Bandung countries of the 1950s, post-colonial states, 150 countries said that Iran has a right to enrich uranium under the NPT. That was not even reported in the United States. They also made a further declaration. They said that the Middle East should be a nuclear-free zone. No state should have weapons in this region. That went unreported. I mean, that's a major declaration. I mean, maybe they were just blowing hot air, but someone could call them on it. I mean, hey, do you really mean this? I mean, this, you put your signature to this. Is this a real, policy shift? Or is it just, just playing to the grandstands or playing to the gallery, as they say in India? That went unreported, which shows you how remarkably disciplined the U.S. propaganda system is to avoid even reporting on those kinds of issues.